Okay, welcome back. So we'll get started off with the lecture. In the last class we were talking about high-speed router design, and we ended the class after a discussion of switching ideas. In this class we will continue the discussion into queuing, buffer management, and classification issues. Okay, so let's get on with this. So what are we talking about? So the overall router architectures looks like this. We talked about the forwarding table, the forwarding decision making, the lookup algorithm design, and then we talked about the interconnect design or the switching fabric design. Now we'll talk about the queuing and classification. So this is a little bit of a misnomer, because queuing and classification occurs both at the input and output. Okay, so this function could there'll be some amount of this function both at the output as well as the input. So don't take it on literally for this case. Okay, so queuing means that basically you put packets into buffers and they wait till they get a chance to be served, right? And this is the essence of packet switching. Okay, the first thing, as soon as you introduce packet switching, you have to support some form of queuing. Okay, it turns out there are two basic ways of doing queuing in a router. One is called input queuing. The other is called output queuing. Okay, input queuing means that the queues are at the input side. Output queuing means the queues are the output side. Okay, it's not quite intuitive. Okay, now the idea is that the fabric itself is non-blocking. Okay, you don't need queues within the fabric. Okay, and in any case, even if the fabric were blocking, the packets would have to be held at the input side. Okay, so output queuing usually demands that since you don't have any queues on the input side, usually this fabric better be non-blocking. As soon as the packet shows up, it should be, you can shuttle it to the output. Okay, not only does output queuing require a fast bus or a fast switch fabric, it also requires a fast output processor. Okay, now this output processor should be able to take packets from any of the inputs simultaneously. On this architecture, input queuing, it is possible that an output might be blocked or the switch itself might be blocked, and you can store the packets on the input side. Okay, so the output can be, so you have flexibility to design slower outputs or slower switch fabrics. Okay, needless to say, most switches today are input queued switches. Okay, even though when we study networking, we think of queuing as output queued, today's architecture do provide queues at the output as well as input, but primarily they are input queued. Okay, because of the flexibility it gives us in terms of cost performance trade-offs of the switch fabric as well as the output processor design. Okay, so with that introduction, in the output queues, right, you can have individual output queues for every input. This way you can deal with, essentially you're using parallelism to solve a problem. If I have number of inputs simultaneously talking, you can map them to appropriate buffers, and each of these are separate from each other. Okay, so this is one way of dealing with it. Or you can have some sort of a shared memory architecture where you throw all these packets into the shared memory and then pick it out. So the memory bandwidth requirements of the first architecture, of course, much more smaller, where here you have the bandwidth scales as a product of the number of inputs. So input queuing essentially allows you much more flexibility. Okay, but input queuing has a general problem. Okay, so suppose I have multiple packets which come. Okay, and suppose I just use a first in first out queue at the input queue. Okay, and the head of the packet, the head of this queue is trying to go to some output, or maybe the switch fabric is blocked to that output. Okay, then what happens is that the packets behind the head, okay, are blocked for no reason, even if the path exists. Okay, so essentially the issue here is that even though input queues provide flexibility in design of the switch fabric and the output architecture, okay, and allow them to operate at lower speeds, now you have a new problem if I use first in first out queues at inputs. Okay, so this problem is known as head of line blocking. Okay, now head of line blocking you can experience if you go on a single lane road and somebody wants to take a left turn. Okay, you'll be hanging out behind the car that wants to take a left turn, okay, because the head wants to turn left and the traffic is coming on the other side, right? So there's again classic head of lane blocking. Okay, if you had another lane, you can essentially like a turn lane, in that case the head, the particular packet which wants to turn, or the car which wants to turn left, can hang out in that lane waiting for the chance to turn. Okay, that's why the turn lanes are so useful. Okay, and you see, you can think a little more about why in some places, like when you have large two-lane roads, you have a separate turn lane going all the way. Okay, whereas if I have just a one-lane road, there's only sometimes a turn lane is provisioned. Okay, and it has only limited buffering capacity. Okay, so all these are to based upon the expected head-of-line blocking which one might have, okay, in a traffic management system in a real highway or in a real road system. So head-of-line blocking is a real problem in scaling the architecture of a router. Okay, now so to deal okay, so the head-of-line blocking actually becomes serious if you consider how the delay actually increases with load. Okay, now in other words, if I have random load coming in at the inputs, distant to outputs, and you can have blocking for the outputs, okay, it turns out that there's a, even before the load at the inputs is 100%, you'll have a dramatic increase in delay. Okay, in fact, the load profile goes up like this. Okay, there's a magic number, 58.6%. So roughly just half of your, so even though the switch capacity is pretty fairly high, even before you reach half of that capacity, you suddenly start seeing a dramatic exponential increase in delay. Okay, this is because the head-of-line blocking phenomena. It comes from standard queuing analysis of random processes. Okay, so people have thought about this problem, and one of the obvious solutions is to add separate queues for every output. Okay, so instead of having a first in first out queuing principle at the input, okay, so you have what we call virtual output queues for at the input. Okay, when a packet shows up, if it is designed to red output, it will stand in the red queue. Okay, so it is possible that you can have head of line blocking within the red queue. Okay, but not, it will not affect the other colors like blue or green. Okay, as simple as that. Okay, so it is possible for you to have parallel paths or simultaneous transmissions between these other things. Only the same color will be blocked. Okay, so this is the basic idea. So the method for handling head of line blocking with parallel queues is sometimes called as parallel iterated matching. Okay, we'll not go into details of this, but essentially it has been used in several switching architectures all the way from old deck switches. Okay, so the summary is that if I use virtual output queues, the load pattern and the delay, load versus delay curve, goes all the way to support a full load. Okay, so in other words, I can increase the load close to 100%, and only that time the delay will shoot up, as would be expected. Like this kind of a curve you see in Ethernet and other sort of technologies, which are random access technologies. You can't optimize it to function exactly at zero delay at 100%. Okay, so the first thing we learn from queuing analysis is that all delay is caused by randomness. If randomness were not there, you will not have any delay. Okay, in fact, if there's no randomness in the size of the packet or in the processing time, okay, or the, even though the bit rate might be constant, since packet sizes vary, right, processing times vary. So, if there's no randomness, that is in the input arrival stream, and there's no randomness in the service stream, you can reach almost 100% load with minimal delay, okay, with just one packet queue. So this is known as a DD1 queuing system. Okay, so when you study an MM1 queuing system, you see that the delay basically shoots up very fast once you increase the load, especially as it reaches this 80-90% threshold. The reason is that all the delay shoots up because of randomness. So the summary is that all queuing is because of randomness. So randomness is bad in some sense. And randomness is good in Ethernet because you can also use randomness to resolve collisions. Okay, so there are two sides of the randomness game. Okay, so we saw in this case, randomness was bad because randomness led to high blocking probabilities, and like you would saturate and have huge delays early on itself. So you need to provide parallelism to overcome this issue caused by randomness. Okay, so this theme comes again and again in networking. Okay, so output queuing is usually the ideal. Okay, in fact, whenever we think about switch design. I mean, whenever you think about congestion control and so on, you always think in terms of output queues because it's very natural. You assume that there is an infinite capacity here, and then you show up, you have all packets queued at the output. That's the only bottleneck. Link is the only bottleneck, we think. So, but in reality, both the switch as well as the output processor could be bottlenecks, and packets are usually stored at the input. There's no issue of head of line blocking here, but the only issue is that they need to run much faster. Okay, and this means more costly hardware. So from a cost performance trade-off perspective, there's an issue. Okay, but there turns out to be an interesting architecture known as the knockout switch design, where you can reduce some cost at the output. Okay, so this knockout essentially organizes this output queue design as though it's a tournament. Okay, so if you do that, essentially it's a dropping policy. So when multiple packets arrive at the same time, you have to drop one of them because you are running out of capacity, right? So you organize this who gets knocked out as though it's a tournament. Okay, so in the first round, randomly you choose out of a pair, one gets dropped out. Okay, and then that packet goes to the second round, and then among the second round you can have random packet loss. So this way the knockout principle only allows you to distribute losses fairly among inputs when there's contention in the output. Okay, so knockout switch designs have been very popular in early switches, okay, for output queued switches. Okay, so that's the end of what we'll talk about queuing. Okay, so the summary of queuing, this is input and output queuing. Input queuing is nice because it's practical, and most switches do have input queuing. Most switches in practice also do have some mix of input and output queuing. Output queuing requires to be much more faster. Usually some of them are designed using the knockout principle. Input queuing, to avoid head-of-line blocking, you use virtual output queues. Okay, that's the basic summary. Okay, now packet classification is a more complex problem than the lookup problem. So in last class, we looked at the issue of when a packet shows up, I need to look it up to figure out which is the output port, right? That we call as the IP address lookup problem or a lookup problem in general. Now, in packet classification, what is the goal? I have a packet which either needs to be classified as input or the output. Why do we care about classifying packets? Okay, we care about classifying packets because I can then put them in a queue or provide some buffer management preferences for them. Okay, so basically you want to do some traffic management on packets. Okay, and you want to provide some differential quality of service. And at every router, you have some building blocks to provide that. Okay, this building block could be a scheduler, it could be a buffer management entity, or a drop, or a priority, or some kind of a dropping mechanism, where you might want to provide preference to one kind of packet and less preference to the other kind of packet. Maybe packets are colored red and green, etc. So to decide on this, right, the prerequisite for this is first you should know what is the packet and what is the type of the packet. And you should classify a packet into some category or some class so that you can provide some behavior for that class or some quality of service behavior for that class. Okay, so packet classification essentially, the simplest form of packet classification is that the packet in a single field tells me what class it belongs to or what kind of flow it belongs to, and then I just use that flow information to throw it into a class, right? So it could be a class ID, okay, or a class field. Okay, sometimes it's known as a differentiated services field or a class field. These are terms which are used in different versions of IP. But in practice, what happens is that you might want to do fine-grained packet classification. Okay, what does fine-grained mean? I might want to identify flows which are sometimes known as microflows, which are actually your TCP flows end-to-end. So if I want to really identify a TCP flow, I need to look at, say, the port numbers of TCP, input-output address. It's the socket pair which determines the TCP flow. And then I might need to look at other fields like maybe what is the protocol type field. Okay, so there might be multiple fields I need to look at. Okay, essentially, what you're doing is you're collecting all these multiple fields, and then you're trying to do a match. Okay, so one thing to do is to collect all the fields and do an exact match. Okay, which is pretty much like a lookup problem. Then you might have more complexity. You might actually have a match which hits multiple rules. Okay, now an application for this is a firewall. For example, a firewall is very, one of its main goals is to classify flows, whether it's malicious or good, right? So it has fairly complex rule structure, and it needs to take fields of a packet header and then map and see whether it matches one or more rules. Okay. So this is very similar to the lookup problem where we saw that I took the IP address, which is just one header field, and then I had to match one or more, one or more prefixes on the table, right? So classification in sense is generalization of the lookup problem. Okay. So that's what I wanted to impress. Okay. So and its applications are in like firewall design or in virtual private networks, anything for security at the edge of the network, or for quality of service, I need to classify a packet into a flow, and the flow is given some sort of behavior known as a per hop behavior. Okay, so typically you have this kind of a predicate, and you have some action corresponding to that. So you have to match appropriate predicates. Okay, now when you're talking about multi-field classification, essentially it has a similar idea. So you might you have multiple fields, and then you might have to look at how many rules it matches, and then there might be some kind of priority rule matching. I have to check the most important rule that it matches, etc. Okay, so just to take a look back, prefix matching was a one-dimensional range problem. So I had this unidirectional range, and then these prefixes could match one or more of these ranges, right? Okay. Now, the longest prefix match or the most specific route is some kind of a range matching problem, or it's called a one-dimensional range matching problem. It turns out the classification turns out to be a multi-dimensional geometry problem. So, to give you an example, so if I have field 1 and field 2, I can view these field 1 and field 2 as two-dimensional ranges. Or if I have more than two fields, I can have a multi-dimensional range. Okay, so in computational geometry, people have actually studied problems of where there's a range matching problem, they call it. Okay, so there have been number of papers which try to look at this classification problem as a range matching problem, and it turns out to be analogous to the one-dimensional problem, just the complexity increases. Okay, so here, for example, you can have a field 2 matching here, and then field 1 matching here, and there could be field there could be some rule 4 which is this part, rule 5 which is this part. So we want to find the most specific rule that matches. Okay, so these are all issues which needs to be considered. Okay, so you can have different prefixes which lie in this multidimensional space. Okay, so I just wanted to give you an analogy to this, and we move on. Okay, so classification has turned out to be a fairly important problem, and processor. So it requires more processing to classify than you might think. Okay. Okay, so if you're interested in actually studying these problems in more great detail, you can choose this as one of your term paper projects, and there are lots of papers, and I think we have put some references on the webpage, on the course webpage, but I'm going to create a more detailed list of term paper assignments. You can either choose them, or you can come up with your own suggestion. So just have some guidelines as to what you need to do for the term paper very soon. Okay. Okay, so the next aspect I'm going to talk about is called network processes. Okay, now this is a new trend that's starting to happen in the marketplace. Okay, so to give you a context for why we're talking about network processes, okay, and the players who are playing in the processor marketplace, like Intel, are playing in the network marketplace, network processor marketplace. So what is a network processor? We saw that, I think I might have, okay, maybe I should go back. If you look back at your slides, we saw that router architectures went through several generations, right? The first generation, you had a centralized CPU, and all the processing and forwarding function was done in the CPU. So centralized CPU was a bottleneck. Then you moved memory and processing to interface cards. Okay. Now what happened was that you moved more and more processing to the interface cards, and then you replaced the bus with a switch fabric, right? So the trend has become to put more memory and to put more processing, both in the fast path as well as in the slow path, on the line cards itself. That's why line cards are where router vendors make their money, because that's where it has to be highly optimized, etc., etc. Okay, and it has high margins. Now, what has happened is that as you go from OC3 to OC12 or OC48 and higher speeds, right? I gave you a simple argument early on saying that software routers, I cannot use general purpose processors even for the slow path, because the processing requirements start increasing very rapidly. Okay, the forwarding requirements started increasing very rapidly. So what happened was that people started with a general purpose processor to do the slow path, and then they used an ASIC for the fast path. Okay, then they started using a more specialized general purpose processor known as an embedded processor for the slow path. Embedded processor basically is a RISC processor. Okay, and then people moved on to replace even that with what is known as custom silicon, or essentially an ASIC for the slow path as well. So essentially the interface card has become, a major hardware optimization problem. Okay, it does. It has to do just normal packet processing, but there are other functions which you might do in a general purpose computer. So essentially the functions you do on these things have to be highly optimized and have to be extremely fast. So a general purpose processor like say an Intel Pentium chip cannot work as fast at the high speeds we might need for OC48 or higher. Okay. So ASICs have become had a field day for a number of years, especially from mid-90s onwards. So what has happened is, but the problem with the ASICs, or application-specific integrated circuits, is that they are highly customized. Okay, so even if I want to go from Cisco version 1 to Cisco version 2, or some version 1 to version 2, you have to replace and do a completely new ASIC design. Okay, because you don't have compatibility across even versions of the same product, leave alone taking the same ASIC and using it in a different product. Like, for example, I might have a gigabit Ethernet switch, I might want to develop an ASIC for that and then use a similar or at least components of that ASIC in another design, like say a high-speed router. Can't do that. Okay, it's very customized. Okay, so what has happened is that we know that processors, on the other hand, are highly flexible. You can program them. But unfortunately, they are slow. They don't have high forwarding bandwidth. So there's been this intermediate space between ASICs, which are very inflexible and require new design cycles and have bloated the costs dramatically, and processors which are very slow and cannot keep up the pace. Okay, so since there's been a demand for higher and higher bandwidth, people have to remain with ASICs. Okay, now as the sort of telecom world is imploding, okay, so everybody wants to cut down costs. So what is happening is that there is this new space in between called a network processor, which allows you to allows you flexibility, especially in the product design across versions. You can use the same network processor and then just reprogram it for your next version, or you can use the same network processor in multiple points within the router architecture, or across one router design and another router design. So network processors are becoming very popular right now. As a building block, network processors are situated at line cards, or they could be situated between line cards. And the switch fabric, or they could be situated close to the output, in several places they can be. So they need to be fairly general. Okay, so their degree of generality is somewhere between that of a full-fledged processor and just something, a processor that is just optimized for packet processing functions. See, if I just want to look at the subset of packet processing functions, like doing CRC and all the usual stuff, TTL and so on, right, I can build a highly efficient processor. I can choose the instructions just for that. Okay, but you also want some generality in that, because you might want to have new applications on it, because I might want to build an edge router which has some new QoS function. For example, we might want to come up with a new routing algorithm or forwarding architecture, etc., right? So we have prototyped it in Linux, and then we are now there. We have actually tried implementing it on a network processor platform. So network processor provides you flexibility for trying out new designs and rolling on new products. Okay, so given that's the strategic thing, there are still some issues of how much economies of scale are there with network processors and so on, and it's also in its infancy. It's only the second generation of network processors at this point. But network processors have come a long way, okay, and we'll see what I'm talking about. Okay, so I will use for my my exposition Intel IXP's network processors. There are other vendors, including Motorola, and there are several other vendors. But essentially, what is the difference between a network processor and a regular processor, right? So a network processor contains a RISC chip, like a strong arm chip. Okay, this is like a regular processor. And you would use this for a number of control plane functions. Okay, like if I want to do routing updates or router updates, right? Like BGP updates or OSPF LSAs and so on. Usually it's done at the strong arm chip. Okay, so this is like a regular processor. Now what it additionally has, it has a number of parallel processing engines. Okay, these are known as micro engines. Okay, the reason they are called micro engines is that the coding for these micro engines, these lie in the high speed data path. Okay, and then there are several of them. In other words, what you can do is you can split up packet processing into several of them. So what that means is if I want to operate at say OC48 speeds or larger, I can take one packet and give it to one micro engine, another packet and give it to another micro engine. Essentially, you are not limited by the clock rate of the micro engine, so you can have many of them. Okay, so typically you have 8 or 16 micro engines in current designs of network processors. So essentially you get a factor of one order of magnitude boost over the basic clock rate. Okay, and on top of the clock rate, these things are also not programmed in high level language, but they are also programmed in microcode. Okay, now if anybody has done assembly level language, you know what I'm talking about. So it's fairly detailed stuff. Okay, and of course like vendors like Intel have been trying to do a lot to simplify programming of these things. Like they provide micro C, which looks like C pretty much, so you can specify high level stuff which will be compiled fairly efficiently into microcode. Okay, now in addition to this, you will have a control processor that's even more slower, and you'll have standard SRAM and DRAM for handling memory and buffers. Okay, usually what you do is you put your packet headers in SRAM and you put your packet payload in DRAM, and usually this serves as shared memory architecture, but you could do other types of architectures. Okay, so the message about network processors is that at least the current generation, which is coming out, and it's already out and it's running in real routers, is that you can do OC192 speeds with network processors today. Okay, now that's a fairly significant achievement. So OC192 or OC48 speeds are possible. So as and also network processors combine a lot of functions, right? So you can take a board, an interface card which looks so big, and you can shrink it much smaller because you can consolidate a lot of functions in a network processor itself. Okay, so this is the idea. Micro engines handle a fast path. They are essentially RISC processors, but they are optimized for packet processing. The strong arm is a more general purpose thing, which not only provides packet processing, you can also run like general code. I mean, you can run your sort of Microsoft Word here, okay, for example, right? So things like that. And it also has hardware support for multi-threading. Even within a micro engine, you can have several hardware threads. So essentially, this is the usual thing which happens. I mean, you're trying, since you can't scale the clock rates, you try to provide several modes of parallelism. You provide multiple processors themselves, which are optimized for particular functions like packet processing. Within the process, you provide hardware threads. On top of that, you can do multiple software threads as well. Okay, so that is the idea. Okay, so as I mentioned, the several types of processors are, you can have an embedded processor, basically a RISC processor. It does all this stuff, but as I said, it's limited because of its general purpose nature and in terms of its speed. And a parallel architecture uses many of them. This is what we saw in terms of microengine. And a pipeline architecture would organize several functions this way. So it turns out that some complex microengines can internally be pipelined as well as hardware multithreaded. Okay, so these are all complexities that are coming up in newer network processors. Okay, and in terms of the software architecture, how do you program this whole business of network processors? You can have a central program that invokes, you can view this network processor as a coprocessor, or you can view the micro engines as coprocessors, and so on. And so at the processor level itself, you can have several types of processors. You can have I/O processors, which are extremely fast, and you can have some embedded processors, which are somewhat slow, etc. Okay, so let's just move on a little more. So you can have a general purpose CPU, as I mentioned, which is highest level functionality. You can provide an administrative interface, command line interface, etc., GUI, and all that stuff. Embedded processor is an intermediate level where it is optimized for speed, but it still has general purpose functionality, whereas an I/O processor like the microengine is just completely optimized for basic packet processing. Okay, it doesn't do any other stuff. So this is like a hierarchy of stuff. So when you have some functions like packet processing, most of the fast path stuff is done at the lowest level of the processor hierarchy. So just like we had memory hierarchy, you also have a processor hierarchy built into network process. Okay, so the lower level of network processor hierarchy are extremely fast, and you have many modules of them. And CPU at the highest level, you just have some basic stuff. Okay, now the other aspect of trying to scale network process. So remember that the essential challenge in network process is that you want to scale up the speeds while keeping the programming or programmable flexibility. Okay, or programmability, which gives you the flexibility, right? So you want the flexibility of the general purpose stuff while you want the speed of an ASIC. Okay, so this is the intermediate balance you're trying to. So how do you scale? Okay, so we saw how to scale processor functions by having a processor hierarchy. So if you want to scale the memory side of things, you do the standard things like caching and all that. Okay, so now we'll talk about memory scaling. So we are dealing with raw limitations on SRAM and DRAM access capacities, 2 to 10 nanoseconds for SRAM and 50 to 70 nanoseconds for DRAM. Okay, now you have several options. Now this is access latency. In addition to that, you have bus capacity to access the memory itself. Okay, now you have options of putting the memory as internal memory on the chip or external memory. Okay, and even within internal memory, you can have levels, and you can think of this as a bunch of caches. Okay, obviously internal memory becomes more costly. You can put lots of it. Okay, they're much faster, of course. Right. So, and overall memory cycle time is a measure that combines both the access latency and as well as the bandwidth of the read and write. Suppose you have highly parallel memory, even if it has a larger access time, you might be able to do your operation faster. Okay, so this memory cycle time and access latency are usually two metrics. Okay, so similarly you have a memory hierarchy. You have external DRAM, you have external SRAM, onboard memory, which is like onboard DRAM, onboard SRAM, and so on. So the largest memory is the least expensive, and memory hierarchy is also carefully designed. Okay. And it turns out that there are a whole bunch of types of memory that are specifically optimized for high-speed communication chips. Okay, so there are synchronized DRAM. This is the kind of stuff which we use in CPU as DRAM. And then there are quad-rate stuff, zero bus turnaround, DRAM and all that. These are optimized for particular aspects, whether you're talking about block transfer, random access, low latency or low cycle time and so on. Okay, so so it is possible that you can have particular units having particular processor capabilities and particular type of memory capabilities. So a network processor is this package that contains all these stuff, piece of units, and gives you a programmable interface there where you have two levels of programming. You can do microcode programming, and you can do the strong arm programming, and you can divide functionality into fast plane, slow plane, control plane, and data plane, etc. Okay, so that's the high level idea. Now, just to give you some more idea of other issues in memory, remember that in memory we have the usual thing of random lookup, okay, or random access, okay. So for random access, normally in the processor world, we used to do caching, right, or several levels of caches. Okay, now caching is also used, and we use the same types of levels of caches in network processors. But it turns out that caching is not as effective in network processors as it is in regular processors, because caching fundamentally, remember, it doesn't work by magic. It depends upon something known as temporal locality of reference. Okay, just because of the fact that your instruction stream is local and your data accesses tend to be local, okay, you exploit the locality of reference of memory, and then you can essentially cache that local, the part which is around where your references are in the cache. Okay, that is the basic idea of caching, and this idea is carried through in multiple levels of caching. However, when you're trying to do high-speed packet processing, the locality of reference basically breaks down. And as you go to higher and higher speed routers, they are dealing with more and more flows, okay, and the locality of reference typically is only within a single flow, even for all the lookup operations. There are very different kinds of operations you might want to do, and you might want to study the locality of reference for each operation, and then figure out whether what kind of cache architectures can support one, if you want to develop customized cache architectures, or you want to develop a general purpose cache architectures for a bundle of packet processing actions. Okay, so the quick answer is that the locality of reference is nowhere near as what is found in processor hierarchies. Okay, so what you do to deal with this is that you provide large caches. Okay, so the caches that are found in network processors are far larger than what you see in processor caches. Okay, so that is one sort of basic thing you do. And you also try to provide associative access to caches more. Okay, but essentially caches fail to solve the basic problem of they don't address the thing which is most critical, which is helping you do packet processing much faster. Okay, so there are another kind of memory which is known as content addressable memory or CAM, which is used for one particular type of operation, which is for classification or lookup. We saw that classification and lookup are essentially versions of the same problem, right? Lookup problem just made more complex. Okay, now content addressable memory essentially is a mixture of random access and pattern matching. Okay, so let's look at what we are talking about, and we want to do this parallelly. Okay, so this is good for lookup operations. Okay, so essential function of a CAM is it is given a pattern to search. Okay, this pattern is known as a key. For example, an IP address could be a key, or an IP address which has a particular mask might be a key, or a combination of an IP address and a TCP address might be a key. Okay, so these could be keys for lookup or classification and so on. And then a CAM will return the first slot that matches the key, or returns all slots that matches the key. Okay, remember this. Now this kind of all slot matching is obviously useful for IP lookup, right? Because you need to match all the slots and then figure out which is the one which is largest prefix, right? So we saw that this kind of a CAM could be used in the lookup problem, where you developed a 2 to the power of 24 sized CAM, and then you just did matching of all of the first 24 bits onto that. Okay, once you took that, and then if you had a larger match, you would go through another CAM. So there's one particular type of CAM called a ternary CAM, which also allows you to mask entries. So it is not that you just blindly mask all the, you match all the bits of the key. You can mask certain bits. Masking essentially means don't care. Okay, if you study all the Carnot maps and all that, right, you have don't cares. Masking just means don't care. You don't care about certain things. So you just take the key and mask this, and then try to see whether it masks, whether it matches the slot in a masked manner. So this is shown in a sequential thing, but essentially the way a ternary CAM operates is completely parallel. So it does parallel matching with the masking operation or with the don't care part. Okay, so essentially this is how a ternary CAM would look like. You would have values which is like an IP address and a mask, and then when you have a lookup query that comes, it immediately goes and tries to, like a destination address comes, it goes and tries to match all the things with the appropriate masks, and then you can have a priority encoder or selection of one of these matches which goes out. Okay, so this is done even for the size of 2 to the power of 24 and so on. So ternary CAMs in more general are used for classification things, not just lookup. Okay. Okay, so if I take a network processor, it looks fairly complex. Okay, so the second generation network processor of Intel is called the IXP 2000 2XXX series, or there is a processor called 2400 and 2800. Okay, so let's just look at the basic structure here. Okay, we see that you have a bunch of micro engines. Okay, this is called micro engine version 2. Obviously, it's a better optimized micro engine. You have, instead of a strong arm core, you have an X-scale core. X-scale has a better power usages as well as higher speed. You have RDRAM, which is a much higher speed memory for this. Then you have PCI buses. You have SRAM and a particular type of SRAM to deal with this. Okay, and you have some scratch memory, which is optimized for hashing. And then you have the usual switch fabric and input-output interface. Okay, so you don't need to remember all these things, but you can just take a look at. You want to reduce the complexity of a general-purpose processing unit. Okay, and you want to have simpler instructions that are more better designed for packet processing. And then you have multiple cores and multiple. When I say multiple cores, I'm talking about multiple engines, micro engines, and within each micro engine you have hardware multi-threading. Okay, and if I look at another processor of the same family, it looks similar. It has fewer micro engines for this case. Okay, now it turns out that this sort of a hash unit can store security hashes like SHA, or it can store other kinds of hashes. Remember, for Ethernet applications, we saw you could do hashing and then lookup, hash-based lookup, and so on. So there is people have identified what are the common things which might be required in packet processing, and then have built capabilities for that. Okay, so I just sort of basically dumped it from one of my Intel friends' presentation here, but essentially you can ignore most of this. The basic message I want to tell you is that it is possible for you to do 10 gigabit per second Ethernet and 192 OC192 processing at a network processor. So what this means is that every interface will contain a network processor which can operate at this kind of speed. It has its own framers, it has all the software, basic building blocks are already available. Now you can then build your own box. Cisco can then, or any checkpoint who wants to build a firewall or something like that, can then take these network processors and then build a board out of it. Okay, most of these functions are integrated. You can do these functions in the network processor itself. It reduces the total number of other chips. Okay, this is the same game Intel has been playing in the processor marketplace also, basically commoditizing everything else around it so that you can build more compact and higher speed packages. Okay, so there are a number of interesting hardware features, like if I want to do shared memory, or a particular type of shared memory called ring buffers, that's one thing which is used. There's something known as the next neighbor register, okay, which will allow you to you can pipeline micro engines themselves, okay, and then you pass information between the micro engines using next neighbor registers, and you can do distributed data caching. And these IXP boxes also allow, IXP process also allows, suppose you have multiple network processors, maybe there's a network processor at the input card, and then there's a network processor at the output card. These, even though they are multiple units, they can in a distributed manner coordinate such that the sum of the total performance is faster than just the sum of these performances. So, it has architectural features that can be leveraged for performance optimization. Okay, so the Xscale core is basically the next generation of the ARM and stuff. It also has a support for digital signal processing. Like, for example, you can build a wireless router or a CDMA. It can interface to 3G, and you can do a lot of digital signal processing functions in it. And obviously, Intel kind of people have been building several protocol stacks for it so that people don't have to rewrite this. And there are, of course, third-party vendors who just sell protocol stacks for particular network processors. This eases the task of somebody like Cisco to build new boxes. Okay. And microengines are essentially RISC processors that have been optimized for RISC as a reduced instruction set processors that have been optimized for packet processing alone. Okay. So, and internally it has pipelining, it has hardware threading, and so on. Okay. So in our lab, by the way, we have a bunch of these Intel IXP network processors, and we also use this in our experimental networking course. If you're interested, you should take it in the next. We offer it every fall. It's offered at the senior level. Grad students can also take it. So we have not actually developed good lab modules for that, but hopefully by the next fall we'll have some interesting lab modules to do both Linux-based software router development, as well as you can do network processor-based development. Okay, so this is another sort of diagram to give you an idea that you have random things which are useful for packet processing, like CRC processing and so on. So there is a CRC unit. Just like you would have an ALU unit in a PC, you have a CRC unit in a network processor just to help you optimize all the key things. Okay, and then you have like highly parallel transfer ports to help you do high-speed transfers, etc. Okay, but beyond that, you don't need to remember anything. And multi-threading can be controlled. You can actually program this using a software development kit. You have multi-threading, and essentially it allows parallelism between in the packet processing itself. Unfortunately, there is only a limited amount of parallelism you can leverage in packets of a single flow, because you have to keep, you're not allowed by TCP to reorder too many flows. Okay, so you cannot leverage multi-threading. So here's an example of a restriction that sounds not too big deal for an end-to-end TCP application, but becomes a big deal for building high-speed routers. If TCP had allowed arbitrary packet reordering, then you could have leveraged this multi-threading to gain more parallelism and much more high-speed throughput. Okay, you can program this using a software development kit, etc. So packet processing, after going through each thread, within each thread you can have stages of a pipeline, and you can program this pipeline. Okay, so I'm just going to skip some of the stuff. So essentially you have a bunch of registers which are both general purpose, RAM, SRAM and DRAM perhaps for registers. As I mentioned, you can break up your header and put it in SRAM, and break up your payload and put it in DRAM, etc. Okay, so there are various kinds of memories, and it could be either local memory, it could be on-chip scratch memory for doing hashing kind of functions, or scratch itself. There are two types of scratch. One is for random access hashing, and then another is for just usually read and write arithmetic operation type of stuff. And then you have SRAM, which is very larger, and DRAM, you see multiple gig. Okay, so what this tells you is that you can have a large buffer size in today's routers. In olden routers, the buffer size was sort of limited. You could not store large buffer size. For today's routers, you can store a huge number of packets in buffer. But usually people don't try to store large number of packets in buffer. Okay, anyway, so in software framework, you can basically you have several ways of programming this thing. And you can program the Xscale core separately. And you have a bunch of core components, you have component library, and all these things are obviously provided. And at the micro engine level, you have a micro C, you have micro block library, and some software development kit for this. And there is a programming model for dealing with the pipelining or hardware pipelining. And one of these programming models is called a micro block. So you can have a piece of code that is called a micro block that can be assigned to in various stages of the pipeline. So that's a sort of software hook to access the hardware level pipeline. Okay, so like companies like Intel also provide you a higher level interface like a micro C, as they call it. So it's a little more detailed than C, and you can generate this code, and then it will be translated into optimized microcode. Okay, so again, as I said, micro block is a way of separating our logical functions for the purpose of pipelining. So these functions could be like things like five tuple classification, IPv4 forwarding function, or NAT function, and so on and so forth. So it's a fairly interesting challenge going forward to optimize and make this programming job much more simpler. Okay, so we have first-hand experience trying to program the Intel first generation of processors, and it's been very, very hard to program. Okay, we keep complaining, and apparently Intel customers complain more than us. Okay, so the second generation, obviously, they run a better job of setting up the programming interface. Okay, so let's see. I'm just going to skip some of the stuff. Okay, so the applications for network processors basically it sits between ASICs and just a general purpose processor. Okay, and it tries to approach the speed of ASICs and tries to give you the advantages of manufacturing scale economics. Okay, and obviously a player like Intel or anybody who has large manufacturing economies of scale, or who can run a shop and have Taiwan Semiconductor or somebody fab their stuff, they can run a fabulous shop, and you can build a network processor. Okay, so it's fully programmable, and it's optimized for packet processing as well as for a variety of applications as well as administrative interfaces, and it can also be used for as a research platform. Okay, and we are starting to use it within our own work, and our goal is that when we come up with new ideas in research, we'll probably be able to prototype it. After we do it in software router, we can then prototype it in a network processor platform, and then we can give out this to, say, somebody who wants to experiment with it. Okay, we can hand out our code and so on. So our goal is also to see whether we can use it as a teaching tool in long-term in experimental networking classes. Okay, so the technical business challenges are that they're trying to push for a shift from ASIC-based paradigm to a software-based application. Okay, now, there's obviously a cost reduction, but it's a process that is starting to gain momentum in several cases, but ASICs are still leading at the very, very high end, like OC192 and OC768 applications. Okay, but as I said, the next generation of processors is already approaching and can handle OC192 speeds. So it's trying to compete with the ASICs at that level. And it's also, there's a lot of technical challenges, whether and this network process can be used as several functions. It can be used as a coprocessor. It can be used to replace the embedded processor. It can be used in different levels of the router architecture. Okay, but primarily it's in the interface card. Okay, that's where it is. Okay, so anyway, so there is a lot of business type stuff here. Okay. Anyway, okay, so I want to sort of finish this lecture to give you an idea of what it takes, what are the today's challenges in designing the next generation of switches or next generation of routers. Okay, today it's already possible to generate, to develop a terabit per second routers, okay, or hundreds of gigabit per second aggregate capacity routers. So what does it take to go to the next step? Okay, what are the issues? Okay, now, so essentially we are talking about the next generation several terabit per second aggregate throughput. Okay, now this is in terms of switching capacity primarily. So if I have 256 OC192 interfaces by 256, right? So, or if I have 64 by 64 OC768, so these are the kinds of high density switches that people are talking about. Okay. Now, this immediately brings you to, if you do the math, you're talking about several terabit per second. Okay. Now, people usually build switch fabrics for as an OEM. So people build switch fabrics, somebody else build pieces of the interface card, things like a network processor could handle that kind of speed, and then you had some ways to build the board. Usually the router vendor designs and also the manufacturing for the entire board. Okay. Now, at the switch fabric stage, you're talking about single stage electronic fabric. Okay. So, and some optical type switching is also coming into the case. Okay. Now, this looks fairly familiar. The network processor is now relegated to the line card, and you have all the buffering capabilities probably within the network processor or outside. Then you have to deal with the switch core. What does it take to develop the switch? Okay, now power becomes a very important issue, and space becomes the other important issue. Remember, when I talked about the first few slides, I said power and space, okay, and volume are main constraints. Okay, so there are standard shelf space required form factors, shelf space power requirements like 2 kilowatt, and per board power constraints, per chip power constraints, all of these are major constraints. Okay, and then there are cooling technologies. I mean, these things develop a lot of heat, right? So there is all kinds of new cooling technologies that are there to just take the heat out of the place. Okay, there is some innovation going on in cooling technology as well. Okay, but I've not really followed what's going on this. So essentially, you are basically given a flat power budget, and you're asked to like go for 4 times the bandwidth or n times the bandwidth. So the power budget remains the same, but you have to go at higher speeds, and the space budget remains the same, but you have to go for the higher speeds. So this is the essential challenge. So this is sometimes captured as gigabit per second per watt. Okay, it's some kind of a density measure. It's increasing. Okay, and now I/O keeps using an increasing fraction of power. So most of the power is being used by the so for the same power budget, right, it's being used by the interface card as well as the switch fabric. So the switch fabric is being starved of power, but yet it has to switch at higher and higher speeds. Okay, and then there are basic CMOS type density issues. So power basically determines the number of chips and boards and so on. Okay, now packaging of all these chips, there are a number of constraints in the packaging. Okay, so there is something, there's a compliance called NEBS compliance. And let's see what is most important in this. So you have, since you have all these kinds of budget at all these levels, right? So the essentially what is happening is that 1 terabit per second systems require multi-rack solutions. Essentially, I showed you this kind of, this is the what I mean by packaging. All the line cards are packaged into separate shelves, okay, because they need to have their own power sources. You have per shelf power budget. And then essentially all these are connected through optical fibers to switches, and the switch itself is on a single rack. Okay, and since you want to have lots of line cards, these are in physical shelves next to the switch, and you have all this mess of wires connecting these stuff. Okay, and you have a limitation on how far these racks can be. Okay, that it's about 30 meter limitation. So this is your switch, and these are your line cards. Okay, so this is a diagram I also showed you for the fourth generation switching architecture, right? So this is what is happening today. So people are selling these kinds of racks and so on. So this is where the router vendors, by the way, make all the money. So there is a measure called the switch internal round trip time. Okay, switch internal round trip time. Let me just go to the next one. So I talk about when switch internal round trip time is how much time it takes to go from your interface to the switch and come back. Remember that this is on a separate rack. So it's not on the same board, okay, it's not on the same box, it's a separate rack. So there is a round trip time issue here itself, okay, and it apparently affects a number of issues in terms of the design. Okay, so so there are some limitations on these round trip time things. So these will affect a number of packet duration and other measures. Okay, I'm not going to go into great detail, but there's just So there's a performance impact, and all buffers need to be scaled by this, because only then you can figure out whether I have a blocking problem at the switch or not. Okay, if I have a blocking and non-blocking problem, I need to be able to have buffers. Okay, and higher and higher speed buffers are becoming more and more harder. So within the fabric, I need to have flow control internally. Okay, so this is known as back pressure flow control. Okay, and now industry keeps demanding more and more speed up. Okay, so the overall switch fabric needs to be speeded up by 2x every generation. Okay, now switch speed up is very costly. Okay, and it also depends upon all kinds of application. You try to get speed up by having several types of parallelism, because the entire hardware Moore's law is not growing. There's a gap between what Moore's law and other access technologies are allowing and what the speed up requirements are. Okay, so things like multicast, packet sizes, and reordering requirements, and or requirements not to reorder, actually limit the amount of parallelism you can gain from this whole thing. So multicast basically complicates everything: buffering, queuing, and switches cannot be blocking. It'll tend to be non-blocking, and so on and so forth. Okay, so so people are seriously looking at whether at the core switches you really need multicast. Okay, but today's thing is that it's often disabled in the field, etc. But still, people demand multicast function, and it raises the cost of the switch. Okay, going on. Okay, so there are several projects going on around the world. Okay, to build next generation routers. Okay, so the one of the sort of prominent projects is at Stanford University, where they're building a 100 terabit per second optical router. Okay, so the objective there is the realization that electronics cannot move things so fast. So how, what is the right way to introduce optics into the switching function? Okay, so and essentially the idea is you're using line cards and you're using high speed optical switching here. Okay, so and you have your standard arbitration to handle the access to the line cards. Okay, and the goal is to have these are known as OC768 interfaces, or 40 gigabit per second, which is the next generation to current deployments, which are OC192 deployments. So you're talking about a number of about 625 interfaces. Okay, fairly dense switch. Okay, so now the I mean, because of the mismatch between Moore's law and or the access bandwidth and memory problems, you have to continually keep re-examining where the bottlenecks are. Bottlenecks keep changing all the time. At the line card at level, memory becomes a tremendous bottleneck if you want to deal with really high speed. So you have a lot of issues dealing with on-chip memory. You had to keep putting more and more chip on-chip memory and simplifying the functions. But you still have the complexity of basic address lookup, packet classification, etc. Okay, so sometimes some of the packet classification, like fine-grained classification, core routers sometimes don't even do. So that way, if I just have to do coarse-grained classification or like label switch-based classification, that becomes a much more higher-speed function. So, so to handle the memory bottleneck, you reduce the basically have a higher granularity of dealing with address lookup also, and dealing with packet buffering and packet classification. So, at the architecture level, you saw the arbitrator, so you, that has computation complexity, and at the switch fabric level, you have both a interesting mix of optics, electronics, and packaging. Okay, so now I'm not particularly familiar with all the issues, but there are several new issues which show up at this level. Okay, so you have now arrays of DRAMs, and all of you can try to do parallel access to DRAMs, you have large DRAMs to compensate for the low access speeds, and you just take the next generation of SRAM and integrate more on-chip SRAM, which is the 2 nanosecond SRAM. you move more and more of the packet headers into SRAM and the packet payloads into DRAM. Okay, so you have a mix of on-chip SRAM and off-chip DRAM. Okay, so you have arbitration problem. Remember, arbitration is basically about switch controller. Switch controller has to basically set up the switching such that you can send packets in particular paths from input to output. You have to reconfigure it at every packet transfer time. It becomes very problematic at very high speeds. Okay, so the configuration is picked to maximize the throughput, not to waste capacity, etc. So the 100 terabit per second router also sort of looks similar to today's terabit per second routers. The only differences are that the switch fabric now becomes an optical switch fabric, much more. You have many more parallel switch fabrics, not just a single switch fabric. And you have the usual racks of line cards. Now, these line cards are bigger and they operate at higher speeds. Okay. Now, each line card looks like this, as I showed you earlier. And you have lots of them, and this is what is there inside. So, in terms of the switching, we'll study optical switching a little more carefully later when we study optics. Essentially, you do something known as passive optical switching. I mean, you're not trying to do fancy wavelength switching and so on and so forth. So you're trying to do essentially a wavelength. The decision made on the wavelength is I want to switch this wavelength to this output. Okay, and this is like pretty much configured, and you can make the switching connection at higher and higher speeds on newer and newer optical switches. Okay, optical switches also are high powered components. To get high speed optical switching at low power is a big challenge today in the industry. Okay. So essentially what will happen is that several functions we believe will be thrown out. Okay, so there will be a little or no support for quality of service and things like that, which require classification functions inside the core routers. All the stuff will be start to be moved more and more to the edge because of the demands for high speed. And I mean, multicast and packet reordering might be there, but more missequencing will be tolerated, and maybe the reordering is handled at the edges of the network. So edges of the network might try to compensate for the reordering which happens in the core of the network and so on. So essentially you're trying to relax requirements, simplify, so that you can focus on getting the packet out of the door. Okay, and less programmability. So which means that network process will not be used in the core, they'll be more and more used in the edges of the network. And I mean, ASICs and network processors will continue to compete and these kind of things. So greater use of optics to reduce the power. Okay, optics in general, for the same amount of electronic switching bandwidth, optics provide lower power requirements. Okay, but still reducing power requirements in optics is a challenge. Okay, and Professor Partha Datta here works on new nanocrystal technology that can provide you much more smaller form factor all optical switching, and can provide femtosecond switching. Okay, so these are all new optical technologies that are happening, and in the future will be able to provide very interesting capabilities. And these kinds of innovations will find their way into much more higher speed switches. And these obviously occur at much larger granularities, like 40 gigabit per second. You don't bother trying to demultiplex things at this level. Okay, so so what is going to happen is that you see more and more, if the cost performance doesn't match up, the core will be more and more replaced with optics or optical networking. And because these are switching more, these switch pretty much similar to how circuit switches used to work. But they work on the granularity of wavelengths rather than time division multiplexed things. Okay. So you see more circuits-like switches, or basically wave division based switches at the core. That's why we're going to study optical networking and what are the ingredients of that in the later part of the class. Okay, so I think that's the summary. Any questions so far? Okay, so remember that in your next class we have exam. Okay, so what we will cover for the exam is up to the traffic engineering thing which I'm going to do in the next class. In the traffic engineering, I don't have too many slides. Okay, I wanted to prepare slides on survivability, and I didn't get around to preparing it. So what I'll do is I'll give you some opportunity in the beginning of next class, or maybe after I cover this traffic engineering, for you to ask questions about the exam, or you want me to clarify or go over some topics, I'll be happy to do that. Okay, otherwise we'll just disband earlier today. Okay, that's going to be the idea. Any questions so far on this router? By the way, the exam is going to be cumulative, okay, in case you didn't know. The weightage for the exams sort of grows. Okay, the first exam was, I think, 15 points, and the second exam is 20, and third exam is 25 points. Okay, because it's cumulative, which means, but there will be larger emphasis okay, on the second, I mean, what has been covered since exam one, obviously. Right. But I don't want you to forget all that you learned before. Okay, so there'll be, there might be some questions. And in general, the exam will be on basic concepts, okay. I mean, you need to understand what's the high level concepts, how to reason about them, what really matters, and so on. Okay, any questions? Okay, so let's see. Okay, traffic engineering. So when we studied MPLS, we and label switching, we argued that it's a good basis for traffic engineering. Okay, so traffic engineering actually encompasses a wide variety of functions inside the network. Okay, it includes anything that depends upon routing is broadly called traffic engineering. Okay, so the next generation of routing can be thought of as traffic engineering. Okay, so routing normally is just about finding a route. In traffic engineering, you not only find a route, but you also map, form traffic aggregates and map traffic aggregates to routes. Okay, that's the only new thing. Okay, now you might want to do this in fancy ways. You might want to do this at the network layer or layer 2 or layer 3. You might want to provide backup paths. Suppose one thing fails. Okay, there are two ways of doing this. This is one way to do it is at the link layer or the physical layer, known as survivability architectures. And the other way to do it is at the network layer or MPLS layer, known as fast reroute architectures. Okay, usually the time requirement or the switching requirement or fast switching requirement for that is different. Okay, at the lowest level, you'd like to do switching within 15 milliseconds, similar to how Sonnet used to handle automatic protection switching. Whereas in fast reroute, you have a little more weaker restrictions. Okay, so these are so there's been a lot of development in the traffic engineering area. So, but we will just look at the basic function of load balancing and mapping traffic to multipaths or to constrained to routes computed based upon quality of service constraints and so on. Okay, so that's our goal. Oops, should not be there. So, what will happen with our traffic engineering? Okay, everybody, this is a very familiar thing in freeways. Everybody chooses the shortest path. Right, and the shortest path is the freeway that connects you from the source to destination. Okay, this is similar to how internet works today. The routing algorithm should choose pretty much a single path or typically some notion of shortest path. Okay, and then you have at the shortest path you have congestion. Right, so this is an analogy with human drivers. Now, if I were to do traffic engineering in the traffic, in the freeway, okay, but there's no effective traffic engineering available today for freeways. But essentially what you would do is when you know that there's congestion, you would divert traffic in ways such that you avoid congestion or you avoid the possibility of congestion. Okay. So what you've done is you've taken aggregates of all traffic going from here to here and then you map it to this path and you take aggregates of traffic going here and so on and so forth. Okay. Obviously, road traffic is not all that simple because people don't just go from here to here. There are a lot more exits and entry points to the freeways, so it's not obvious how to do traffic engineering. Usually, the traffic engineering technology which is used in roadways is that depending upon the level of occupancy, which is like buffer occupancy, the entire freeway is like a buffer. Okay, so you do ingress control. Okay, that is, you have a traffic light at the entrance of the network, and the rate at which it allows cars into the network varies, okay, and also the speed of the traffic roads also changes. Okay, suppose there's an accident, the whole thing crawls to almost a grinding stop. Okay, so suddenly the network capacity or the forwarding throughput capacity has changed, whereas you don't have such kind of problems in internet. Okay, you don't have cars breaking down on the internet. Okay, you have packets which might be thrown out. You can't throw out cars from the internet. Okay, so you have to be careful about analogies. Okay. Okay, so we've looked at this definition. It's that aspect of internet network engineering where you're talking about performance optimization and you typically care about in operational ISP, IP networks. Okay, and the people found it more and more important to do because there was a more and more cost focus and offering more services in the ISPs. But you couldn't do this very efficiently with typical routing algorithms because it's all shortest path based. If it's shortest path based, the subset of the shortest path is also the shortest path. So if I want to transfer flow from A to E, and I want to transfer flow from A to D, both of them will follow the same prefix path, or the first part of the path is going to be the same. So I could try to change the weights, which is an indirect way of trying to tweak the paths chosen, but then you will remap both these flows. Whereas you cannot, you don't have the flexibility to, in a fine-grained manner, send one flow like this and the other flow like this. This is the essential problem in a single path. I mean, it has nothing necessarily to do with the shortest path. Even if I'm forced to a single path, this is the problem. And there are other assumptions that you can only do this if I have quasi-static traffic. What this means is that the traffic distribution coming from inputs to outputs, okay, also known as a traffic matrix, you expect it to be somewhat stationary, okay, so a quasi-stationary. In reality, internet traffic is not stationary, okay, and stationary means that the statistics, right, if you think that the traffic actually is a random process, its statistics and correlation over time changes, okay, with time. So, if all correlations don't change over time, it is known as a stationary process. And there are weak sense stationary and all these, you learn all about this in random process. But essentially, internet traffic is none of the above. Okay, so it's the worst you can expect. Okay, it has all kinds of bad behavioral modes and so on. Okay, but you do have to assume that at some level of granularity, at some level of aggregation, you have the statistics or correlations are stationary. Okay, only then you can make decisions about how to map this traffic. Because if you make a decision to map the traffic, and by the time the traffic statistics have changed, what's the point? You're not solved any problem, right? So it also requires a priori knowledge of the demand matrix, which may or may not be available. Okay. So essentially, and more importantly, which is not mentioned here, is when you have to make a change. Okay, whenever you have to change a traffic aggregate from one path to the other, you also have to change the route, okay, which means you have to send around LSAs or you have to send around BGP updates and so on. Okay, so this takes a while to converge, and as I mentioned, OSPF convergence has been addressed, and you can have faster and faster convergence in OSPF, but you just have a flood of LSAs to deal with. Whereas BGP convergence is still a long time scale event. So as a result, the kinds of packet aggregates and the granularities, time granularities over which you make these changes or traffic engineering decisions are large. Okay, what that means is that you don't try to change traffic mappings every second. You try to do it over several hours or maybe one day or time of day or a few hours in a day, morning, evening, afternoon type things. Okay, so that is okay for some ISPs. Okay, but bigger ISPs are looking for even finer grained traffic engineering capabilities to be able to define traffic aggregates in smaller granularities. Maybe all voice over IP traffic I might want to define, or maybe voice over IP traffic of my platinum customers and so on. So I might want to be able to define more flexible, finer grained aggregates, and then I might want to be able to remap them very quickly depending upon network conditions, etc. Okay, so this is known as finer grained traffic engineering, which is not possible both in BGP policy based routing or in OSPF to a great degree. Okay, so the quality of service and the SLAs which you can offer to your customers, SLA stands for service level agreements, which you can offer to your customers, which normally specify the availability of your network, the quality of service you offer in your network, will become weaker and weaker because you cannot do this traffic engineering. So it's a very important issue for the ISPs. So fine-grained means not only fine-grained in terms of the size of the flow, in terms of bitrate of the flow, but it also means fine grain in time. I should be able to quickly map and remap traffic. This is the overall goals. Okay, so the fundamental requirements are to be able to map and remap traffic to paths. Okay, LSP is one kind of a path. Okay, and you might want to be able to monitor and measure traffic and measure whether you're actually meeting your quality of service requirements, whether you're meeting the SLAs which you offer to your customers, otherwise you have to pay money back. Okay, many of these have financial liabilities along with them. Okay, and usually you'd like to be able to specify explicit paths in either on an arbitrary basis or by running some sophisticated anti-hard heuristic type algorithms, which will find paths for you that have particular combinations of delay constraints, bandwidth constraint, loss constraints, and so on. Okay, so there are sophisticated quality of service routing. So there's a separate field of quality of service routing which goes into what are the algorithms which you can find in polynomial time, what are the algorithms which are MP-hard and so on, and what are the heuristics, and there are heuristics available for almost every case. Okay. So, and then you can characterize an LSP on various attributes, okay. So, and these attributes are at low level, application might be defining at them at a very high level, so you need, you have a mapping problem of trying to map application level attributes to low level attributes, then you have a problem of finding routes for these fellows, etc. And then you might want to reroute or select alternate LSPs. Okay, I'll just stop at this point and we'll continue this in next class.